Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now we venture out on the first Triangle Business Journal of the new year. And here's a look at the biz page. Under the heading Great Cause, the article, Holt Brothers Ready to Party with NFL Playoffs. The NFL playoffs are here, and not many get more enthusiastic about that than the Holt Brothers. Torrey and Terrence Holt, who played at NC State University before their professional careers, will hold their fifth playoff party on January 21st at Reynolds Coliseum. It's always a good time and raises money for a good cause. The event is a fundraiser to benefit children with a parent battling cancer. The Holts lost their mother, Ojeta, to cancer in 1996. The party has raised $600,000 in its first 4 years, and the funds have aided more than 1,000 children. Last year, about 700 people attended, and the party raised $169,000. The Holts are now active in the local construction business, and their Holt Brothers Construction Company was involved in the $35 million renovation of Reynolds completed in 2016. And speaking of sports, under the heading of one option is how to see Georgia play Alabama for cheap. Biz couldn't help but chuckle when seeing tickets to the showdown between the University of Alabama and the University of Georgia for only $17 on StubHub. But, of course, there was a catch. That was for the January the 6th men's basketball game between the two schools in Athens, Georgia. The football game on January the 9th, well, that's a different story. How does starting off paying 100 times the cost of that basketball ticket sound? And we're at the beginning of the new year, so here's an article where those resolutions matter. It's a week into the new year. How is your New Year's resolution holding up? If you're in Raleigh, probably pretty good. If you're in Winston-Salem, perhaps not. The financial website WalletHub evaluated New Year's resolutions and outcomes and then ranked cities by whether those resolutions held up. Seattle ranked number 1 overall, and Raleigh a healthy 23. Charlotte 28 and Durham 50 weren't far back, but the triad? Greensboro came in at number 106 and Winston-Salem number 142. Gosh, Winston-Salem. Biz knows Moravian cookies are tempting, but maybe it's time for an apple. And under the heading of Cakes Available is the article about an event space that opens in downtown Cary this spring. A Raleigh baker is opening a new event space in downtown Cary, but he promises that prospective couples looking to get hitched won't have to buy wedding cakes from him as well. That's not a requirement. You can definitely print that, quips Todd Mozinga, owner of the Edible Art Bakery and Dessert Cafe. Mozinga has signed a lease at Midtown Shopping Center to open a 4,500-square-foot event space called Chatham Station. Doors could open this spring. Mozinga described the 50-year-old space as industrial chic, outfitted with exposed brick and piping. He's designing and managing the space in partnership with local wedding planner Sarah Schumay, owner of Sweet Sarah Bell Weddings. They plan on hosting weddings, bar mitzvahs, and corporate events. Mozinga hatched the idea for the business while working his other job, running the bakery, where he does 200 to 250 weddings per year. Downtown Cary is growing, but seemed to be missing an event space that would resonate with younger generations, he says. Chatham Station is supposed to fill that hole. And on the record this week, here's Mark Vintner, the senior economist at Wells Fargo. So Vintner made an interesting point about North Carolina's economic engines on January the 3rd when speaking to an event for the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. The Triangle and Charlotte have accounted for about 70% of North Carolina's gains since the last economic recession, Vintner said, pointing out that the Triad is just now posting solid economic gains. One of the problems those other areas are facing is they're seeing that a lot of their young people go off to school and they don't come back to Winston-Salem. They go to Raleigh or Charlotte. And finally, the last article on the biz page this week, A private dorm surge changes Hillsborough Street. College students swarm back to campus this week. And if you think all students are headed toward the musty dorms of yesteryear, you haven't been on campus in a while. Apartment complexes with an upscale feel are rising. And Raleigh's Hillsborough Street is getting a new look and feel as student housing development soars on the site of the old Velvet Cloak Inn. Theory Raleigh, a project being built by Atlanta-based Peak Campus, expects to start housing students in August, property manager Margot Amico tells Biz. Introductory rates start at $779 per month. By comparison, single occupancy rooms at NC State University dorms cost a little more than $3,000 for the spring semester. The Velvet Cloak, which opened in 1963, was demolished in 2017, and it had 174 rooms, but of course, all weren't occupied at once, especially in recent years. Theory Raleigh will have 150 apartments, from 1 to 4 bedrooms, and expects to house 525 residents. The development has 290 parking spaces in its garage. Amico says the move-in date is August the 17th, and Theory Raleigh expects to open a week earlier. Private residence halls were once rare. In fact, Granville Towers was the country's first private residence hall when it opened in Chapel Hill in 1964, but that has changed quickly. In 2015, Raleigh developer John Kane opened Stanhope, the $80 million, six-story student complex on the other end of Hillsborough Street. Stanhope has 300 apartments. By comparison, Sullivan Hall on the NC State campus has 12 stories and can house 713 residents. Now, this week's Triangle Business Journal is organized a little differently than normal, and it has as its major offering this week 2018 Stories to Watch. And here are 7 articles on various places. So the first one, the future of the Rocky Mount Rail Hub is now uncertain. This is a story that Triangle Business Journal has been following for several months now. And here's the latest article. Officials in North Carolina remain optimistic that train giant CSX of Jacksonville, Florida, will see the value of a planned $275 million terminal, even after the company confirmed it is reevaluating its entire intermodal strategy. CSX announced plans in 2016 to build the Carolina Connector in Rocky Mount, a $270 million intermodal terminal that could transfer massive cargo loads between trucks and trains. But after months of optimistic statements, the company is reviewing its business model and has declined to say whether the project will move forward. No one wants to say it's not happening, and that includes the economic developers who worked to secure CSX's interest after residents pushed back over its original site in Johnston County. Multiple officials, including Governor Roy Cooper, have said CSX might use the terminal in a different way than what was initially planned. In North Carolina, the project was supposed to elevate the state's status as a transportation hub, allowing for better logistics access throughout the East Coast. But for CSX, whether the intermodal strategy makes business sense is being questioned by its management team. The company was dealt another major blow with the unexpected death of CEO Hunter Harrison on December 16th, the author of the turnaround plan. Harrison, a legend in the industry who previously led Canadian Pacific, became CEO on March 6th, long after the company had committed to the Carolina Connector. Shortly before his death, Harrison said change would be inevitable. When I came on board, the first thing I told people was there was going to be change, and there's going to be a lot of change. And change brings issues, as we human beings resist change, he said in December at an investor conference. During the same speech, he told a crowd of analysts he had never been a huge, strong advocate of intermodal because it's so difficult to make a buck on it and a return on your assets. New CEO Jim Foote has said he plans to continue on the trajectory Harrison started, but it's unclear what that means for the Carolina Connector. When asked for an update on CSX's plans, NC Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland said in a recent interview that there was nothing I can talk about. He confirms his office is in frequent communication with CSX. The stakes are high, as recruiters have said the terminal was a major economic development selling point for the state. When announcing the project for Rocky Mount, officials said it would create 1,500 jobs in eastern North Carolina. Then-Governor Pat McCrory called it a logistics facility that will connect us with the rest of the United States of America. And in the second of our stories for this week's TBJ, on the health front comes the article UNC and Carolina's Wedding of the Year. The intended marriage, not merger, between UNC healthcare system and Carolina's healthcare system, and whether the two parties can actually pull it off, will dominate North Carolina's healthcare landscape in 2018. On August the 31st, 2017, the systems announced they had signed a letter of intent to begin negotiations for a massive combination. Last year, UNC Healthcare posted a record $3.6 billion in revenue and an operating income of $196.6 million, while Carolina's healthcare posted revenue of $9.8 billion and operating income of $422 million. UNC Healthcare, based in Chapel Hill and featuring a heavy Triangle presence, currently employs about 30,000 people across the state, while Carolina's healthcare employs about 60,000 people. So far, the two systems have not revealed details of their discussions. Specifics of the deal, which the two parties have repeatedly emphasized is focused on cost savings at a time when U.S. spending on health care tops $3 trillion, are still being fleshed out and will be subject to intense regulatory scrutiny. And the question remains as to who would actually benefit from the heralded cost savings, the hospitals, the communities they serve, or the patients. If you were to talk to most of the citizens in the state, they would tell you that health care costs remain too high and still remain a concern for them, said North Carolina Senator Jay Chaudhry, a Democrat from Wake County. Over the past two decades, there has been massive consolidation when it comes to health care systems, said North Carolina Senator Jeff Tart, Republican from Mecklenburg, shortly after the letter of intent was announced. Tart has spent 40 years consulting in the healthcare industry, including mergers and strategic plans. He said much of the consolidation is aimed at achieving economies of scale, a term used by CEOs when companies merge to reflect duplication of services, especially in back-office operations. And Nicole Dozier, director of Health Advocacy Project at the NC Justice Center, posed the question, is that saving really going to pass on to consumers? In 2018, there may be some answers. Roper said earlier this year that the wedding of the two parties could come in early 2018 to be followed by regulatory review, including by the Federal Trade Commission. We believe we're looking at the possibility of starting this new endeavor in the summer of 2018 in a little less than a year, he added. Of particular concern will be the impact to rural communities in the state. The parties have said the mergers would improve health care outside the metropolitan areas, where many local hospitals are struggling or even closing. I certainly applaud the overarching goals of expanding access to rural health care and growing UNC's academic reputation in the medical field, said Chaudhry, particularly given the uncertainties when it comes to the future of the Affordable Care Act. But if the engagement becomes a marriage, he said, the question will be whether the marriage constitutes a monopoly. And as a result, does the monopoly create higher reimbursement rates and ultimately higher health care premiums for consumers in the state? And continuing with our top seven stories for 2018 comes the article in 2018, Housing Supply to Chase Demand in Triangle. Buying a home in the Triangle was not the easiest task in 2017. Prices were up more than 8.2% through November, and because of low inventory, the amount of time a home buyer had to close on a deal was minuscule. Across the region, the average time a house sat on the market through November was down to 44 days. That's a 10.2% decrease compared to 2016. All of this was particularly true for people seeking lower-priced homes. Of the 26 fastest-selling subdivisions in the Triangle, all but two had average home prices below their respective countrywide averages, according to an analysis by Bo Bromhall of Fonville Morrissey Realty. Some residential real estate agents don't see this trend changing much in the new year. New residential construction will continue to come online, but it won't come close to satiating the market. The builders are still struggling to keep up with demand, says Linda Kraft, chief executive of Kraft Residential in Raleigh. Residential construction continues to trend upward, but is nowhere near pre-recession totals. In the third quarter of 2007, the number of new homes under construction was just below 16,000, according to Metro Steady data. By mid-2009, that number had plummeted to below 5,000. Through the third quarter of 2017, the Raleigh-Durham market was up to nearly 12,000, representing a significant recovery, but nowhere near previous highs. At the same time, job and population growth continue to increase, and continued upward pressures on prices will likely push first-time and lower-end buyers to look farther afield for a place to call home. That will mean places such as Johnston, Franklin, and Granville counties, and the outskirts of Wake County, could see more action. All that said, the residential real estate market remains strong, observers say, in terms of overall economic growth and sustained demand. The lead of everything is the economy, and as we keep growing the economy and people keep moving here, those are all customers, said Stacy Amundson, author of the Triangle Area Residential Realty, or TARR, report, and appraiser at Birch Appraisal Group in Cary. One potential hurdle for new residential construction could be competition, with the rebuilding efforts underway in regions of Florida and Texas hit by Hurricanes Irma and Harvey. Construction activity and demand in post-hurricane areas will likely drive up the cost of materials and labor elsewhere, Anfinson says. Coupled with the rising cost of land, the end result could be that prices of new homes in the Triangle will increase even more above the price of resale homes. On a positive note, Anfinson says that many of the new jobs being added in the Triangle in industries such as tech and life sciences have higher than average salaries. Zooming out even further, the Triangle's housing market remains in a relatively good place when compared to other growing metropolitans. According to one real estate consulting group, Raleigh's market is still in healthy recovery mode. In a typical boom-to-bust housing cycle, Raleigh's positioned at about the halfway point, according to a research note from John Burns Real Estate Consulting Firm. This is a good thing, according to Amy Steiner, a manager at the firm. It means new home sales prices are rising, as are the new home sales due to the demand, she wrote in an email. And in a related article comes the article, Towns on Edge of Triangle Benefit from Boom. As Triangle's influence continues to increase through population growth and economic development wins, outlying communities are reaping big benefits of that expense. The Triangle has long been touted by its economic development cheerleaders for its intelligent workforce, with its proximity to first-class higher education institutions and its relatively low cost of living. Those attributes are being highly pushed as the area tries to lure Amazon's HQ2 and the 50,000 jobs that may come with it. Meanwhile, the cities and towns on the outskirts of the area are pitching a collective strength, proximity to the Triangle. That includes access to Raleigh-Durham International Airport, combined with a lower cost of living than one finds in the Triangle's metropolitan areas. But these certainly are not the only ingredients in the eau de parfum these outlying areas are using to attract employers. City, county, and state incentives are being doled out for the promise of jobs, industry diversification, and future spending within geographic boundaries. And yes, those carrots are being snapped up. But location and demographics are paramount as to why these places are ending up on short lists. Take Mebane, for example. It's a city about 50 miles northwest of Raleigh that's quietly building an arsenal of industrial parks, filling them with fast-growing companies. Mebane is spread across Orange and Alamance counties and has seen its population grow from 7,300 in 2000 to more than 14,000 now, with projections for 32,000 people by 2035. Among the recent announcements in Mebane was a 450,000-square-foot warehouse for Walmart that employs 600 people. That's more than 100 jobs than it initially promised. The company was offered a $1.1 million incentive grant from the state and another $4.4 million in incentives from local town and county governments. Mebane also nabbed European grocer Lidl's 900,000-square-foot warehouse facility that will house 200 workers. And metal framework designer and manufacturer Prescient completed another 135,000 square foot building that employs 45 and expects to eventually house more than 200. Mebane Mayor Glendal Stevenson gave most credit for the town's recent boom to its spot on the map, as roughly 100,000 vehicles pass by the city every day on Interstate 40 and 85. In a 2017 Wallet Hub study of most educated cities in the U.S., the Durham-Chapel Hill Metro came in number 4, with Raleigh posting a number 15 ranking. The employer base is also expanding with recent announcements by companies such as Infosys and Credit Suisse, which are bringing in a combined total of 3,200 jobs to the area. Incentives helped ultimately lure those deals as well, but the main attraction that these companies noted was talent. North Carolina Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland said that's consistent with what happens in most site selection searches. It always comes down to talent, he said. Other outliers are touting the Triangle region's talent to gain attention from outside employers as well. In December, Triangle Tire announced it decided on the Kingsboro megasite in Edgecombe County for its 800-job manufacturing project. And again, says Carolina's Gateway Partnership CEO Norris Tolson, it was the location and its nearby inhabitants that influenced the decision. Regardless of how well you recruit, if you don't have the tools a client needs, the availability of good labor, the quality of life, the location, if you don't have all that on hand, they tend to move on to some other place really quick, he said. The thing that turned it for us is it's just an outstanding site. Looking ahead, these far-reaching parts of the Triangle could gain even more steam. Two blockbuster deals on the horizon that might further boost the Triangle's mighty reach are the aforementioned Amazon deal and the planned Toyota Mazda electric vehicle plant. Even though the Triangle has also been on the losing end of some notable Echo Devo deals, such as Foxconn and Mercedes-Benz, the area has had some major wins in the past year. Look out for more of these deal talks to include the ERA in 2018 and for those lesser-known areas flanking the Triangle to push hard for more attention as well. And in another of the 2018 stories to watch comes the article, Volatile Year Ahead for U.S. Economy. As we start the year with federal tax reform behind us, numbers are beginning to emerge relating to the overall health of the U.S. economy and the forecasted performance of the Triangle as a whole. While economists differ on the growth rate of the U.S. economy in 2018, some actually predict an economic slump. Experts who follow the North Carolina economy, such as Mark Vittner at Wells Fargo, Harry Davis at Appalachian State University, and Michael Walden of the NC State University, all believe communities in the Triangle and the Charlotte area will continue to prosper, despite economic headwinds in the state's rural communities. But let's break the larger picture down in segments. First off, overall. Economists believe the U.S. gross domestic product, that is the GDP, will continue to grow at about 2.5% in 2018. They also expect it to drop in 2019 to 2.1% and 2% in 2020. For North Carolina, the gross state product, that's the GSP, is expected to increase 2.2% this year, higher than 2017, according to UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton. On the inflation and interest rates front, most experts believe the inflation rate will remain below 2% in 2018, but will be above the 1.7% in 2017. For reference, the Federal Reserve likes the inflation rate to be around 2%. So the Federal Reserve is expected to raise rates at least 3 times this year to control the country's core inflation rate. Also, the Fed already has started reducing its $4 trillion in Treasury bonds. It acquired all these bonds following the Great Recession. Most economists believe the action to reduce the Treasury holdings will increase the yield on the 10-year T-notes. That, in turn, likely will increase long-term interest rates, such as 30-year fixed mortgages and corporate bonds. What about corporate debt? This is seen as a crippling problem for observers such as Mark Yusko with Chapel Hill's Morgan Creek Capital Management. As the chart on the right shows, obviously you won't be able to see that, U.S. corporations are drowning in debt. Some believe the tax reform will allow some of these companies to lower their debt position. Others believe corporations may use the windfall from tax reform to buy back their shares to boost stock price. A tightening of the economy could create havoc on the financial strength of corporations carrying large amounts of debt, as borrowing will become expensive and creditors will get nervous. Some triangle companies, such as INC Research, $3 billion, Martin Marietta Materials, $1.6 billion, and PRA Health Sciences, $1.3 billion, have amassed massive amounts of long-term debt. But thanks to steady streams of revenue and margins, analysts do not see much concern. But one bad economic cycle could change all that. On the jobs front, the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates in its Occupational Outlook report that the country's total employment will increase by 20.5 million between 2010 and 2020. The fastest growing sectors that will create the most jobs include health care, personal care, social assistance, and construction. Wells Fargo's Vintner says the triangle will add about 25,000 new jobs in 2018, a number that will dip slightly in 2019. Vintner estimates that tech will continue to be the fuel for the triangle's economic engine. Finally, midterm elections. As it becomes clear by mid-year that the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate may see significant swings come November, things may actually slow down in the third quarter as companies will wait out the volatility. A change in the House or Senate will likely most open new discussions on immigration, trade, and labor issues. No series of articles about stories to watch would be complete without one talking about dining. So here's the article, Restaurant Scene Booms. Local, niche, and healthy. These are some of the restaurant trends that have emerged in the triangle that industry and town officials expect to continue into 2018. And something new is on the horizon this year, food halls. Chapel Hill, Durham, and Raleigh each plan to open at least one of these culinary incubators next year, though nearly all had originally planned for a 2017 opening. The food hall allows local vendors, both established and startup, to share kitchen facilities while having their own spaces to serve guests. In Raleigh, Morgan Street Food Hall is expected to open early in 2018, and transfer company Old East plans to launch in the summer. Also, Durham Food Hall and Blue Dogwood Public Market in Chapel Hill are expected to open soon. Having both Morgan Street Food Hall and Transfer Company means we will have a big influx of small food vendors with space in downtown to test and grow and expand their brand, says Bill King, Senior Vice President for Planning and Development of Downtown Raleigh Alliance. And restaurateurs hope to benefit from more dense areas as mixed-use developments become more prevalent. These new projects are not exclusive to downtown, as residential development is being incorporated into shopping hubs. We've taken the path of helping to create environments that are supportive of specialized retail and restaurants, says Dwight Bassett, Economic Development Officer of Chapel Hill. Our best example is the ongoing transformation of the former Ephesus Fordham area in Chapel Hill, with a rebranding initiative now called Blue Hill District. Another trend that's likely to continue is chefs opening new locations. In Durham, we've seen many of the already popular chefs open second, third, and fourth restaurants, says Shelley Green, President and CEO of Durham Convention and Visitors Bureau. Consider Durham chefs Scott Howell, that's Nana's, Nana Steak Bar, and Bar Virgil, and Matt Kelly, that's Vin Rouge, Malio, and Lucky's. But it's not limited to Durham. Raleigh's Ashley Christensen, that's Poole's Diner, Beasley's Chicken, Chicken and Honey, and Death in Texas, has also come to define dining experiences in the community. In 2017, the brother and sister duo behind popular Laotian restaurant and bar Bida Manda in downtown Raleigh opened near neighboring brewery Bavana. In December, Bavana was the only North Carolina restaurant on Forbes' list of the 10 coolest places to eat in 2018. A lineup that included destinations around the globe. The restaurant business is booming and creating jobs. The North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association projects a 4.4% increase in North Carolina restaurant sales for 2017 over last year, rising to $18.6 billion. The industry currently supports about 458,400 jobs across the state. and that number is expected to climb 15% by 2027 to 527,000 jobs. Now, completing our survey of the top stories for 2018 comes this development story. Capitol Boulevard changes mark, major growth in corner of downtown Raleigh. The Capitol Boulevard Bridge that arches over Peace Street dates to 1948 and, in many ways, remains a bridge to Raleigh's past. Now, however, that part of Raleigh and the bridge that serves it are undergoing a dramatic change. How that space, a key front door to downtown, evolves will be a major storyline in 2018. The roads will change and development will rise, changes that have already revamped the area. Finch's Restaurant, which had hugged the aging bridge for seven decades, closed a year ago and moved to Durham. Also pushed out were a longtime shoeshine shop, a cleaning store, and even a pawn shop. On the horizon are more multi-use towers, new shops, and even a grocery store. But will the changes include a new soccer stadium on the lip of the state government complex? The Triangle's bid for a Major League Soccer team wants to put a stadium along Peace Street. Steve Malik, owner of North Carolina Football Club, had a simple explanation as to why his group picked that spot. "That location is special," he said. "But putting a stadium so close to the General Assembly and on prime state property comes with hurdles." Malik said the team has had positive conversations with the state about a long-term lease. But with MLS looking to announce two more expansion teams in 2018, Malik said, "Now we've got to move past dialogue and move it forward to action." Ford Porter, spokesman for Governor Roy Cooper, said the governor's office has asked the North Carolina Department of Administration to review the proposal. All leases or sales of state property have to be reviewed by the Council of State, which meets on January the 9th. Some transactions must be approved by the General Assembly. Malik's bid is also looking for a major investor, but the uncertainty of the stadium situation has impacted that search. As Malik pointed out, any investor wants to know the status of the stadium and the lease. Meanwhile, construction of a new road plan continues. Construction began in September 2016 and is scheduled to take 3 years. Once complete, it would include bike lanes, wider sidewalks along Peace Street, and planners expect a smoother transition for the thousands of cars streaming in and out of downtown. The massive project has sparked intense developer interest in the space. Already, John Kane of Kane Realty and Cross Williams of Williams Realty and Building Company are planning a mixed-use project at the corner of Peace and West Streets. That project, according to the Klein Design website, will include 445 apartments and 61,000 square feet of retail. The project is expected to be completed in 2019. It will also include a Publix as downtown finally begins to add grocery store options for those who live there. The Kane-William Partnership has been buying land and old buildings that make up the site's more than 4 acres. Since 2008, it has paid a combined $21.4 million worth of real estate in the neighborhood. Also, William Peace University's master plan calls for significant expansion on its campus as it looks to raise its student base from 1,000 students to 1,500. Peace also owns the Seaboard Station complex, which it purchased in 2013. That complex is scheduled to add a Harris Teeter. Now we head to the Around the State page in this week's TBJ. The article is Top Charlotte Architects Head Uptown. Charlotte's largest architectural firm will move to Uptown by early 2019. Little Diversified Architectural Consulting, whose service lines include architecture, engineering, and land planning, will move it out of its long-term home at 5815 West Park Drive to 615 South College, where it will lease 60,000 square feet across 2.5 floors on floors 14, 15, and 16. The firm's lease is up in July of 2019, its principals say, which prompted a look at what other real estate options in town could be a better fit for the company. CEO Phil Kuttner says a survey was distributed to 175 people in the local office to determine what was most important in a new corporate location. "I think partly because we had been so isolated here, They wanted to be in the mix of a lot of diverse kinds of people and businesses, he said. Little has been at West Park Drive for at least 30 years. The firm opened in Charlotte with fewer than 40 employees who worked out of a small office on the second floor of its current building, which the company originally owned before selling it to an REIT, Gladstone Commercial, for $9.2 million in 2004. Today, Little leases 68,000 square feet in the building and employs more than 200 people. The space doesn't allow for the type of collaboration Little sees in some of its other offices. That's Durham, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Orlando, Florida, and Beijing. The West Park Drive office was built in a similar manner of other 1970s-era offices, with an abundance of private offices, walls, and wood paneling. Little has made some modifications along the way, including an incubation space that helps foster collaboration, but company leaders say it's still not ideally designed for maximum productivity. Because we work so interdisciplinary, having people be able to come together from multiple studios and collaborate on a project, and giving them the space to do that so they're not constantly doing it virtually, will be very important for the way we work, Chief Financial Officer Terry Bradshaw says. The new space will feature a three-story interconnecting staircase and will allow furniture to be moved and rearranged based on needs. The search for a new home for Little, which keeps its largest office in Charlotte, began with 33 real estate options in existing or future developments. Along with Cushman and Wakefield, Little executives whittled the list down to about a dozen candidates that they then toured, or in the case of to-be-built projects, met with developers about. At first, it seemed like an adaptive reuse project in a former warehouse would be the best fit, Bradshaw said. But ultimately, there weren't enough options in that type of space in a location Little and its employees desired, surrounded by people and businesses. Now we turn to the business profile for this week, and the business profile this week is a group called CAHEC, which is the acronym for Community Affordable Housing Equity Corporation. It's headquartered in Raleigh with 38 employees. Its CEO is Dana Boole. They have an annual revenue of $12 million as of 2017. They were founded in 1992. A little bit more background about CAHEC. Community Affordable Housing Equity Corporation was created in 1992 and bills itself as a nonprofit regional equity syndicator. The organization helps provide communities with affordable housing and opportunities for growth and revitalization by investing in qualified tax credit products. Since its founding, CAHEC has raised and committed more than $2 billion, a figure it recently hit, toward the development of more than 28,700 units of affordable housing throughout the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic region. CAHEC also recently completed an 80-unit project at Wakefield Commons in Raleigh. For the 16-county Extended Triangle region, CAHEC has helped develop 78 communities that provide housing for more than 8,800 residents. The equity capital for those projects was $230 million. So in all of North Carolina, CAHEC boasts 268 developments with more than $780 million in equity capital. So Triangle Business Journal caught up with CAHEC CEO Dana Boole for an update on his organizational plans. And here's a Q&A with Dana Boole. What's CAHEC's mission and how has that evolved? Our mission is to provide communities with affordable housing and opportunities for growth and revitalization by investing in qualified tax credit products. Our primary investment vehicle has always been the low-income housing tax credit. Yet over the past decade, we've expanded our strategy to include new markets, historic, and energy tax credits. We have two primary beneficiaries, residents and investors. The residents we serve, those making upward of 60% of area median income, are provided safe and affordable rental housing and reside in communities near the services they and their families require. The investors earn federal tax credits, yield a fair market return, and have the opportunity, if they are a bank, to meet Community Reinvestment Act, that's CRA credit. What's the most significant project CAHEC has helped develop here? Carousel Place is a 55-unit new construction LIHTC property that's low-income housing tax credit, just in case you're not familiar with the acronym. An LIHTC property serving seniors age 55 and older in downtown Raleigh. Developed by Capital Area Developments, an affiliate of the Raleigh Housing Authority, as part of the Chavis Heights Hope 6 public housing development, Carousel Place allows seniors to remain in their community in safe housing. It opened in 2007 and has 40 one-bedroom units and 15 two-bedroom units, with rents targeted to seniors earning 30% to 60% of AMI. CAHEC invested $5.8 million of that LIHTC equity in the $7.4 million project. So how far does CAHEC's geographic reach extend? Our portfolio spans 10 states: Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Effective December 31, 2017, we have $2.1 billion under management, 644 communities, and meet the housing needs of approximately 80,000 residents. So how does the passage of the recent tax bill affect CAHEC? The last 10 years has been a concerted effort by the affordable housing industry to educate officials and legislators on the merits of tax credit-based community investment programs. Our impact is evidenced by the recently sponsored federal House and Senate bills to modernize and expand the LIHTC and make permanent the NMTC. Although they have yet to be adopted, these bills elevated the discussion. That said, community investment tax credits were among the minority of tax-advantaged programs preserved under tax reform. So what are some of the challenges ahead? The biggest challenges are maintaining a sustainable advantage in an increasingly competitive and commoditized marketplace, launching new initiatives that prudently further our mission, and attracting and retaining the highest quality staff to meet those needs. So what's the most pressing issue affecting low-income housing in the next 5 years? We're certainly pleased that essential tax credit programs were preserved under tax reform, yet there's still an abundance of work to be done. Examples include necessary modernization and expansion of the LIHTC, permanency of the NMTC, access to additional sources of funding, and so forth. The path to success is increased awareness through ongoing legislative outreach. CAHEC recently hit the $2 billion mark in equity funding. How significant is that for an organization? The proverb, "It takes a village to raise a child," certainly applies here. CAHEC's team of internal and external partners, working as a cohesive and empowered group, is the reason we have had success. Capital under management is simply a byproduct of that effort. An ability to further our vision while maintaining peak performance has been our metric for success. And finally, what are your goals for CAHEC? Our short-term priorities are furthering two emerging platforms, CAHEC Capital, that's lending, and CAHEC Foundation, that's charitable. CAHEC Capital, a nonprofit affiliate of CAHEC, was established to provide a range of loan programs for developers to ensure their LIHTC communities are viable. We were recently designated by Treasury as a certified development financial institution and project material loan growth in the immediate future. CAHEC Foundation, a nonprofit affiliate, improves the quality of life for youth and young adults through wellness and education. Our focus of offering these life-changing initiatives began with CAHEC's community investments, in which CAHEC has granted $13 million plus of its funds to assist residents and communities. Our long-term goal is to further CAHEC's vision, expand the impact of programs and services, and end each day knowing residents are better off because of our efforts. Now turning to the small business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the article, "Cryptocurrencies Entering Mainstream." This article is actually written by Jim Verdonik, who leads Wharton Smith's FinTech Group in Raleigh and is the author of "Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment and Platform Regulations." Cryptocurrencies Entering Mainstream. If 2017 was the year of the Bitcoin millionaire, what will 2018 bring? Answer: coins and blockchain entering your everyday life. Think that's a wild prediction? Well, did you know there's a Bitcoin ATM at Crabtree Valley Mall? It's outside of Sears on the second floor. If you can buy Bitcoins at your local mall, how long will it take until you can spend Bitcoins at the same shopping mall? The answer? Not long. SEC-compliant tokenized securities offerings facilitated by blockchain will replace unregulated initial coin offerings for companies raising capital. I'm working on such an offering now. One Bitcoin was worth about $14,500 the last time I looked, and people around the world are spending fractions of Bitcoins. A friend of mine paid for movie tickets in Japan using small fractions of a Bitcoin. Remember the American quarter used to be called 2 bits? 2 bits is derived from the Spanish piece of 8, the first global currency, and was legal money in America until the 1850s. People used to literally cut these coins into 8 pieces because a whole coin was worth 8 Spanish reals. So 2 bits were 2/8 or 1/4 of an American dollar. So people around the world have a long history of using whatever currency works best for them. Don't think it won't happen again. What about coins other than Bitcoin? The second biggest coin, Ether, is issued by the Ethereum network. In many ways, Ether is more useful than Bitcoin. The Ethereum network executes smart contracts that work in a very determinative process. If a network of computers verifies that X happened, then the smart contract automatically causes a payment to occur. That means you can do business with people all over the world without worrying about getting paid. The best part is you can do all this without paying an intermediary to hold money or verify transactions. 2 people, any place in the world, can interact directly and securely record their transaction. Wow! Of course, blockchain and coins are interrelated, but blockchain is much bigger than coins. Blockchain is a distributed ledger that records transactions in blocks of information. The blockchain is a chain of these information blocks. Once the blocks have been accepted by the network of computers, it's impossible to secretly change recorded data. That means it's an extremely secure system of tracking who owns what. Because the information is encrypted and stored in hundreds of computers, hackers can't steal or change it on one computer. This is vital to many industries, including real estate owners, financial institutions, supply chain management, and energy. If you want to know more about Bitcoin, about blockchain, let me know. I coordinate the Research Triangle Blockchain Working Group. We meet several times a year to discuss the latest blockchain developments. Well, now we've reached the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, so here's the article, The Editor's Notebook. Consider the source when making decisions. By the time you read this column, there's a very good chance you've been to 2 or 3 economic forecast events hosted by local chamber and government officials, and have read a multitude of articles talking about our monetary policies, labor force, and industries likely to shine in 2018. In the end, it's also likely you're more confused than ever. You really don't know the path, but want to believe that this economic expansion in its 9th year will continue through 2018, maybe 2019. At the annual Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce's economic forecast on January the 3rd, Wells Fargo economist Mark Vintner cited several economic factors that have convinced him 2018 will be a banner year for economic growth. He said the recently passed tax reform actually would lower our deficit because of the tremendous upside in bolstering our GDP. More jobs, more spending power, and people paying more in taxes because of an accumulation of new wealth. Shortly after Vintner comes in Mark Yusko, the former investment manager at UNC Chapel Hill and the current managing director of Morgan Creek Capital Management, who excitedly professed that the world markets are heading toward economic doom. Vintner used graphs and charts, and Yusko did the same. So folks attending the conference, while enjoying the differing forecast, came out of the meeting with nothing. Some people leaving the conference said that, while entertaining, there was very little to take home. That's where I disagree. Vintner and Yusko are forming their viewpoints through their own economic prisms. While they may have taken some liberty with their conclusions from some of the patterns, Vintner thinks the expansion will continue well beyond 2018. Yusko thinks things have gotten so frothy that the downside will overpower the positive indicators very soon. If Vintner's correct, he will join hundreds of economists who believe the current cycle of economic growth will continue. But if Yusko is spot on, he will join a select list of people who could say, "I told you so," and be on television and in newspapers and blogs opining on how they saw this doomsday scenario happening before it actually happened. Remember Meredith Whitney, the financial analyst who called the problems with Citigroup and others back in 2007, when she said banks are paying out dividends that were greater than their profits and would ultimately lead to many bankruptcies? She was right on. Wall Street collapsed soon after, and we had the Great Recession. Whitney became a superstar, at least until she forecasted that 50 to 100 cities and counties would face municipal bond defaults in 2010. That never really happened. The point is, when you listen to economists, you need to see the source of their paychecks. Vintner works for Wells Fargo. Yusko has monetary interest in shorts. What they're saying in public makes sense, but for you to react to what they're saying, not so much. But as always, information has value, and Vintner's and Yusko's contrasting looks at the U.S. and global economy demand attention. In this instance, the Raleigh Chamber did a service for its members. Also appearing on the Viewpoint page is an article by John Hood. John Hood's chairman of the John Locke Foundation. The article is entitled, "North Carolina's Rising National Influence on Issues." When Congress enacted tax reform a few weeks ago, the final product bore a striking resemblance to the state tax changes North Carolina's legislature has enacted since 2013. That's no accident. Our state's influence on national politics and policy has been growing for years, a trend likely to continue in 2018 and beyond. The broad outlines of fundamental tax reform have never really been in dispute, at least among conservative and centrist policymakers. The tax code exists to pay for necessary government services, not to engineer social outcomes. It ought to raise revenue at the least possible cost to economic growth and personal freedom. Generally speaking, revenues are most efficiently produced by levying low tax rates on broad tax bases. However, it's possible for the base to be defined too broadly, in a way that punishes savings and investment by taxing them multiple times, while consumption is taxed only once. That's why policies such as tax-deferred savings accounts, deductions for plant and equipment purchases, and tax breaks for households with additional children. Child-rearing is the always primary form of human capital investment in any society, are not merely consistent with fundamental tax reform. They're required by it. On the other hand, narrower tax breaks that favor some behaviors, industries, or financing mechanisms over others are inefficient and unfair. North Carolina's new tax system reflects these principles. For the personal income tax, the General Assembly capped itemized deductions while dramatically increasing the standard deduction and expanding child tax credits. The new federal tax plan does precisely the same thing, for the same reasons. North Carolina also slashed its corporate tax rate, recognizing that corporate taxation is really an economically costly form of double taxation of the incomes of shareholders, workers, and consumers. Again, Congress did the same thing, for the same reason. North Carolina's influence on the national conversation is hardly limited to tax policy. Other states are studying and seeking to emulate our state's recent regulatory reforms, expansions of school choice, and transportation funding reforms. North Carolina is also the envy of other states in our careful approach to fiscal stewardship, which has produced a top-rated savings reserve, high bond ratings, and a series of healthy budget surpluses, while other states struggle to pay their bills. Our congressional delegation includes the powerful head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that's Richard Burr, the chief deputy whip of the House, that's Patrick McHenry, the head of the committee overseeing federal education policy, Virginia Fox, the former head of the Congressional Black Caucus, G.K. Butterfield, and the heads of two key conservative caucuses, that's Mark Walker of the Republican Study Committee and Mark Meadows of the House Freedom Caucus. If current population trends continue, North Carolina will gain a bit more political heft after the 2020 census with the addition of a 14th seat in the U.S. House. Only five other states are projected to gain seats. All are southern or western states. Nine states, most in the Northeast or Midwest, are projected to lose House seats and correspondingly sway in the Electoral College. While North Carolina has gained influence, that doesn't mean our state has made all the right calls or has all the right answers. We still have a lot to learn from other states on a variety of issues. In the healthcare sector, for example, North Carolina regulates both the delivery and the financing of medical services more heavily than the average state does. More to the point, our political discourse suffers from the same malady evident in most of the rest of the country, a coarseness, a nastiness, an inability to argue one's case forcefully and passionately without accusing the other side of evil intentions or rank stupidity. I'd love to see North Carolina set a national example here as well. Of course, we're going to disagree. You may well think some of the policies I've just discussed in this column deserve condemnation, not praise. Fine. Argue your point. And as you know, Triangle Business Journal frequently features people that are on the move, and this week's issue is no exception. A couple of new hires here. Leanne Nance has been hired as a chief strategy officer with Stewart. Nance's primary responsibilities as CSO include brand development through new business and strategic partnerships, as well as strategic planning and implementation of initiatives. Nance also has served as principal of Britt Nance Collaborative and COO at the Research Triangle Regional Partnership. Mary Cromenhook, a real estate broker for Coldwell Banker, Howard Perry, and Walston. Coldwell Banker, Howard Perry, and Walston is proud to announce its affiliation with real estate broker and certified relocation specialist Mary Cromenhook. A top-producing Triangle realtor, Cromenhook joined the residential real estate company's Cary office to better support her Western Wake clients. Also under professional recognition is Nelson Fernandez with the Rachel Kendall team. Listing partners are proven top performers who pride themselves on facilitating smooth transactions for every family, starting with the sale of their home. They're dedicated, trained, and knowledgeable about the intricacies of the real estate process to ensure we meet the goals of our clients. Well, that music can only mean one thing. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is regularly available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138.